Well, listen, if you want to turn to Exodus, if you want to turn to Exodus 4, we are continuing through pinnacle moments of the Old Testament in order to look how they fit into the overall redemptive story of that God saves us, ultimately leading to Jesus Christ, and how each one, even throughout the Old Testament, how it all fits into that to that plan that God had. And we've got to the point where it was spoken about last week with regards to where God met Moses. He came in form of a burning bush. And he basically said to Moses there in chapter 3, verse 10, he says, "Now go, I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people out, the Israelites, to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt." So the Israelites were God's chosen people. They had been kept in captivity and slavery in Egypt by Pharaoh. And they had cried out to God to rescue them and to save them. And at this point, God has heard their cries and he's going to answer their prayers, and he's picked and nominated Moses as a spokesperson who's going to go back into Egypt in order to rescue the people. And he does that there in in verse 10, where he says, "Moses, I'm going to send you back." And of course, how this really fits in, and it's no secret, there's not really a build-up to it, but this is what we're seeing here is a shadow. Is even with all the imperfections, we're starting to see an outline of how there is a group of people, of God's chosen people, who are in slavery. And today, people are bound in slavery and sin. And God chooses someone, nominates someone to go and actually free them. And it paints a picture for us about what is going to come, about how he's faithful with his promises and how he can rescue his people. And at this moment, we can see it with a group of people, with the Israelites, and he's sending Moses. And whenever I was reading this again and again, it really warmed my heart, you know, the fact that at this stage, we can see how God uses imperfect people such as Moses. Because I think a lot of us can actually identify ourselves with them. I mean, whenever we think about Moses, we think about this great leader, don't we? We think about this leader who was kind of like in charge of a great nation, and he must have just been someone who you're just kind of like complete in awe with. And the first thing we see whenever God appointed Moses and requested Moses to go back to Egypt is Moses full of self-doubt, lack of confidence, lack of trust. Because all he continuously says to God is to say, "Listen, don't send me. I'm not able to do it." And you have to be sympathetic to him. I mean, this is Pharaoh. This is the richest and the most powerful man in the world at this time. And Moses is turning around and say, "Well, who am I to go to this guy and actually request that he lets them go?" And this, whenever we look at chapter 4 and chapter 5 and chapter 6, and we're not going to go through it or read every single word at the moment, we're going to work our way through it. This self-doubt and this lack of trust continues there in chapter 4. And even when Moses kept on asking, you know, "Don't send me, and they'll never listen to me, and who am I, and please send someone else." At the beginning of chapter 4, it's entitled there, "Signs for Moses." And that's really where God says, "Listen, Moses, I need you to understand something. You're not going in your own authority. I'm not picking you because of your ability. You're going there because of me. It's me in charge. It's God who's sovereign all of this. It's my plan. You're going in my name." And that's why in chapter 3, again, God announces himself to Moses, "I am who I am. I have always been. I always will be. I always have. I am the creator. Everything else is created. And you have to stand, Moses, that you're going in my name." So he gives Moses some signs, miraculous signs, in order to show and demonstrate the authority that he's going in. And so he tells Moses to throw down his staff, a stick, a walking stick. He throws it down on the ground. And he tells him to pick and it turns into a snake, sorry. And he tells him to pick it up with a tail, which is the completely wrong way to pick up a snake. It's the most dangerous way you can pick up a snake, but it turns straight back into his staff. He then tells Moses, "Look, put your hand under your cloak and bring it back out." And it's full of leprosy. And this is a disease, which is quite topical today, that they have no control over. It's an epidemic. It's spreading. No one knows how to control it. And yet God says, "Hey, you know whose authority you're going under? Put your hand back in your cloak." And it comes back out and it's healed. even then says, if they don't believe those two signs, go get a cup of water from the Nile, from the River Nile, which is the most, the source of the Egyptians' authority and all of their income. It's their lifeline, and he gets a water and he tips it out and he turns it into blood. And he says, you understand, Moses, you're not going in your own ability, but you're going under the name of God, Yahweh. I am who I am. And Moses still struggles, still believes it's to do with his ability and the fact that he's not able to do it, and keeps pleading with God in order to send someone else. Now, I don't know if this is topical or not, but I actually quite like sharing stories about what happens in the life of the church. But hopefully it has a point to it. We had a Thanksgiving meal, which is a meal that the deacons run here, and they organize it with regards to invite our friends and our family and people who don't know Jesus or just want to get in contact with the church. Takes a lot of organization, and quite often in it we have a speaker. We have someone who shares their testimony. So I went to Mark, who's back there in the wheelchair, and I said, Mark, will you be able to speak? And he kind of probably refused it 10 times, did you? Probably kept on saying no, or you actually just started to blank me altogether whenever I asked him. I actually had to go around his house in order to get an answer for it from him. The thing with Mark is he eventually agreed to do it, but he can become quite ill. And he just says, listen, you can't really book me in, or can't guarantee that I'll be there, because he fights a lot of infection. And whenever that happens, he's not able to move out of the house. He has to protect himself. And right enough, probably about 2 hours before the meal starts, he rings me and says, hey, Steve, listen, I'm waiting on blood tests. I think I've got an infection here and I won't be able to come. So that's fair enough, Mark. We knew that might be a possibility. But truth be told, I was sat there thinking, crikey, what am I going to do now? We've got a Thanksgiving meal coming up. Someone's going to give their testimony. What are we going to do? We walked through a number of options. And then someone suggested to me about Paul. Don't know whether he's here, Paul Nicol. And he's not the most, wouldn't proclaim himself as the most public speaker in the world. He's, in fact, he'd probably say he's the complete opposite to that. Very nervous guy. Didn't, you know, wouldn't propel himself ever at the front. And I rang him. I said, listen, Paul, would you be willing, in order to speak and share your testimony at the Thanksgiving meal? And I got this big sigh. And he said, Stephen, I've promised myself never to say no. And whatever I'm asked, I'm just going to say yes. So he said, I'll do it. I just thought, and that stuck with me, by the way. That's why I'm sharing it. It's always stay with me, the way that he answered that question. But then right enough, Mark rang me back probably about 10 minutes after that, and he said, listen, I've got the all clear. I'm able to come. So then I was able to ring Paul back and say, it's all right. Your prayers have been answered, Paul, because I reckon he was flat out praying for your healing. If anyone doubts that the prayer of healing doesn't work, Paul's prayer is a case for it. And Mark was able to come, and it was a great evening when he was able to give his testimony. And my point is here is obviously Paul's willingness. The fact that even though he felt he was not able, even though he knows he's not the greatest speaker, it's like, where is God asking me to serve? It's not always going to be in public speaking. It could be any area of the church. But where is it that God is asking me to serve, and am I willing to actually serve him? I mean, how many of us, and believe me, I'm speaking to myself here as well. If anyone knows me, I know I give this bravado of being the most confident guy in the world, but you can speak to my own family. How many of us have used our own insignificance or a lack of confidence, or what you perceive to be a lack of ability, to prevent you from carrying out what God is asking you to do? Now, again, I know Moses is going in front of one of the most powerful men in the country at that time, or in the world at that time, which is no doubt terrifying, but he had a role to play in God's mission. And we've been studying Acts, and I continuously always seem to refer back to Acts all the time, and it's because of the mission that we are directly called upon. So I'm asking us as a church, and you individually there, what is preventing you from playing your role in mission? Do you feel that your ability at the moment is just limited to you turning up on a Sunday, you're listening to someone blabber on for half an hour, you take a cup of coffee and you go? Because that is not what is asked of us. Moses was worried. And in chapter 4, he continuously goes back to God and he says, look, I'm not able to do this. Even all the signs that received. In verse 13 there of chapter 4, Moses said again, pardon your servant, Lord, please send someone else. A couple of verses before that, back in verse 10, Moses says, pardon your servant, Lord. I have never been eloquent, neither in the past, nor since you have spoken to your servant. I am slow of speech and tongue. I'm not able to speak the way Clive's done there. I'm not able to pray. Do you know what? So I'll never pray. And that's what a lot of our thinking goes on. And that's where Moses is going on. And God's sitting there saying, you don't understand my method. You don't understand who I choose. See, there's no need for Moses to be insecure here. I don't really understand his insecurity and why he keeps on doubting and why we continuously keep doubting. Because God has actually told Moses already what's going to happen. In chapter 3, I know I'm jumping back and forth, but I think it's the right way to do it here this morning. In chapter 3 and in verse 12, God lays out exactly what's going to happen to Moses. He says, and God said, I will be with you, and this will be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. And when you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain. He even goes on to the latter part that I won't read now, the end part of chapter 3, exactly what's going to happen, exactly how the Egyptians are going to be led out of Egypt, how they're going to have treasure with them, and they're going to worship God. So Moses knows the outcome, and yet he's still full of self-doubt. And we know what God's mission is. We know what's been asked of us. We know whose power that we go in. And yet some of us struggle with so much insecurity. And what I learned through here and why I got so encouraged this week is because God loves doing big things through little people. He loves doing big things through little people. And do you know why he does that? So all the power, all the praise, all the glory goes directly to him. It's a pattern that happens continuously all the way. I mean, think about it. At the end of chapter 4 there, at the end of chapter 4, whenever Moses kept on saying, pardon me, Lord, please send someone else. Look at verse 14 in chapter 4. Then the Lord's anger burned against Moses, and he said, what about your brother Aaron the Levite? I know he can speak well. So immediately I thought, well, hang on a minute, God. Why didn't you just go straight to Aaron? If he's the public speaker, and you're going to go to one of the most powerful men in the world, cut out the middleman, forget about Moses, go straight to Aaron. He's obviously the man who can go with great respect, and he's eloquent in his speech, and he'll give the right impression to a man in authority. Why don't you go straight out? Why don't you go straight to him? And then I was thinking about church, as I always do, and I kind of get consumed with it, and I thought, isn't that exactly the human way of thinking? Yeah. Oh, well, he can, he can't, so we use them. And straight away, you've heard this a number of times from the front, we fall into a two-tier system. Yeah. Oh, there's people who God has appointed, who God can use, and I'm down here somewhere. Yeah. So I'll turn up every Sunday, and I'll watch someone fumble and mumble, or listen to someone who can give prayers, or listen to the musicians who can. I will listen and take note of people who can, and my role is just to label myself as someone who can't, so I'll sit back in the chair, and that's my role done. And that's not what I understood here. That's not the way that God is using people. What have I written down here? I'm not able to speak to others about Jesus, we think. Or I'm not able to help to someone with issues. Or I'm not able to get alongside someone in my engaged group. I'm not able to actually invite someone over on my Connect Week, so I'll just won't get involved in all of these things. There's people who can do all of that. I've actually written down, and that's why churches seek to call the perfect pastor. Because do you know what? I want someone who can do all the pastoral care issues perfectly, who can love all of them and meet all your needs. I also want that person who can preach perfectly. And just, he's a joy in order to listen to. And he throws in a few jokes now and again to make it really funny. I want that person. I also want to employ that person because they're a perfect evangelist. Because I can't really go out in the streets and evangelize or talk to people at work. So therefore, he's got to go out and do all the evangelism. And straight away, churches, they fall into, let's push them forward, let's elevate them, and I'll just take a seat back. We've got suddenly a two-tier system. God didn't use Aaron. God chose Moses. And God is looking to use you and I in our role within mission. Often our system isn't God's system. God chose to use Moses, and he did so because then everyone would know that God is at work. And I didn't really want to labour this point, but I am going to labour the point, so I don't know why I just said that. I love, again, referring back to Acts, I love Acts 4, right? Whenever John and Peter, they're going around, they've been anointed by the Holy Spirit, and they're starting to tell people about Jesus, and suddenly the religious leaders, the Sanhedrin, all the elders and all the rich and all the eloquent people, they suddenly capture Peter and John, and they bring them in order to question them, in order, what are you doing telling people about Jesus? Okay, why are you doing all of this? And I love this in verse 13, just listen to it. And when they saw the courage of Peter and John and realized they were unschooled, ordinary men, they were astonished, and they took note that these men had been with Jesus. Now, if that doesn't encourage you to get off your seat and be on mission and to be involved, then I don't know what else. Forget about it. The two-tier system. You are the tier. You are the system. And here we're looking how God is choosing Moses, even though he could have chosen other people. So the ability to reach out and to make Jesus known doesn't come from our own strength, but it comes from God. And even right at the beginning of Acts, it says, and you will receive power to when the Holy Spirit comes on you, and you will be my witnesses. We've heard it time and time again. I personally have repeated that verse. Do you actually believe it? Are you sitting here, you listen to it, and it makes no difference in your life? Or are you actually going to step out in trust and in faith, full of self-doubt? So whenever Moses continued to have these doubts and he continued to struggle, saying, God, I'm not able, verse 11 should actually squash all of our self-doubts and all of our lack of confidence. Because the Lord said to Moses this, who gave humans their mouths, and who makes them deaf or mute? Who gives them sight or makes them blind? Is it not I, the Lord? And then at the beginning of verse 12, so therefore, now go. That's it. That's the full stop. There's no question. There's no doubting after these things. So then Moses went, and he went with Aaron. And at the end of chapter 4, in order to make our way through these three chapters here, at the end of chapter 4 and verses 29, Moses and Aaron, they met with the Israelite, the leaders of the elders of the Israelites there. It says, Moses and Aaron brought together all the elders of the Israelites, and Aaron told them everything the Lord had said to Moses. And he also performed the signs before the people. That was in order for them to know that they're coming with God's authority, for them to ensure what they're saying is true. And then in verse 31, and they believed. And when they heard that the Lord was concerned about them and had seen their misery, they bowed down and they worshipped. I love the way chapter 4 finishes. It finishes with so much hope. It finishes with so much joy that these people had been in captivity for over 400 years, generation after generation, had prayed, had petitioned in order God, in order to release them. And suddenly Moses and Aaron turn up and they say, God has heard your cries. Listen, I can show I'm coming under the authority of God by performing these miracles. And do you know what? God has heard you and he's going to release you. And they go and they bow down and they worship. Can you imagine them going home and telling their family and the excitement that came? And then we're going to get into chapter 5, and it is like a bombshell. It is literally like someone walking up to you with a baseball bat and cracking you over the head. There's so much contrast between how chapter 4 finishes and the start of chapter 5. And I want to work my way through this. We're going to read from chapter 5, 1 to 9, and then a few more verses at the end. Okay, this should be up on the screen. I'm not too sure. If you can follow it, Graham, and move it on as I read this out, please. Afterwards, Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh. So they've told the Israelites what's going to happen, and now Moses and Aaron are making their way to Pharaoh, the great ruler in order to tell them that he must release God's people. So afterwards, Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and said, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Let my people go, so that they may hold a festival to me in the wilderness." And Pharaoh said, "Who is the Lord that I should obey him and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, and I will not let Israel go." Then they said, "The God of the Hebrews has met with us. Now let us take a 3-day journey into the wilderness to offer sacrifices to the Lord our God, or he may strike us with plagues or with the sword." But the king of Egypt said, "Moses and Aaron, why are you taking the people away from their labor? Get back to your work." Then Pharaoh said, "Look, the people of the land are now numerous, and you are stopping them from working." That same day, now this is what you need, this is the consequences here, okay, of what Moses just asked from Pharaoh. That same day, Pharaoh gave this order to the slave drivers and overseers in charge of the people: "You are no longer to supply the people with straw for making bricks. Let them go and gather their own straw, but require them to make the same number of bricks as before. Don't reduce the quota. They are lazy. That is why they are crying out, 'Let us go and sacrifice to our God.' Make the work harder for the people so that they keep working and pay no attention to lies." Now jump down to verse 13. "The slave drivers kept pressing them, saying, 'Complete the work required of you for each day, just as when you had straw.' And when Pharaoh's slave drivers beat the Israelites' overseers they had appointed, demanding, 'Why haven't you met your quota of bricks yesterday, today, as before?' Then the Israelites' overseers went and appealed to Pharaoh, 'Why are you treating your servants this way? Your servants are given no straw, yet we are told to make bricks. Your servants are being beaten, but the fault is with your own people.' And Pharaoh said, 'Lazy. That's what you are, lazy. That is why you are keeping saying, "Let us go and sacrifice to the Lord." Now get to work. You will not be given any straw, yet you must produce your full quota of bricks.' The Israelite overseers realized they were in trouble when they were told, 'You are not to reduce the number of bricks required for each day.' When they left Pharaoh, they found Moses and Aaron waiting to meet them, and they said, 'May the Lord look on you and judge you. You have made us obnoxious to Pharaoh and his officials and have put a sword in their hand to kill us.'" You need straw in order to bind the bricks together. The straw was obviously given it to them, and now they have to spend time in order to go and collect it, and they're not able to meet the quota, so they're being beaten. And this isn't the way that they expected things to unravel. This is not what the people of Israel were expecting, and it isn't what they asked for, certainly. And in fact, in verse 22, Moses actually turns round to God, and he asks God. Moses returned to the Lord and said, "Why, Lord, why have you brought trouble on this people? Is this why you sent me here?" There's loads of questions and there's loads of doubts, and they don't really understand what's going on at this time. The things that were happening were not what they hoped for, and they certainly weren't what they expected. And I think a lot of us have been in that situation as well, where we have had prayers, where we expect God to answer them in certain ways, and yet they haven't been answered in the way that we want them to. I think for me, anyway, this is actually where the rubber hits the road with this. This actually spoke a lot to me about what type of God we actually desire within our own hearts. See, we've got front row seats right now about God is actually how he rescues his people and how he works things out in order, not for necessarily for our good, but for his good and for his glory, even when we can't see it. And as I said, I would believe that every single person in this room would have a testimony or story to tell us about how things worked out differently in their lives to how they actually expected or to how they wanted to or even to how they prayed to. Maybe you felt God hasn't answered your prayers the way that he should have, and you're confused and you've got lots of questions, like the way Moses has here. And the challenge for me here is, are we following and worshipping God, the true God, the one who went back and said, "I am who I am. I am the creator. Everything else is created. I've always been." Have we got a reverence? Have we got an awe? Have we got a respect of the fact that he is God for being God? Or do we actually play around with religion here And we actually require God to be more like a genie character, performing to our wishes and our wants, and ultimately then that we are our own gods. So these people have been in slavery for over 400 years. So you've got to understand, whenever Moses and Aaron turned up and said, this is what God's going to do, they had expectations in their head. They had a way that this was going to unravel. And now things have gone from bad in order to worse. And it seems as if God has lost complete control. And whenever I was thinking about this, and I read a few things about it, one of the commentators said this phrase: who you ultimately work for is who you ultimately worship. Who you ultimately work for is who you ultimately worship. Now let me try and explain this, or at least the way that I understood it. Whenever Moses and Aaron met with the Israelites at the end of chapter 4, they performed the signs and the miracles, and they told them exactly that God had heard their cries and they're going to be rescued. It finishes with them bowing down and worshiping God. And when you worship something, you serve it. They were worshiping and serving God because he'd heard them and for the things that they'd heard. But now things have suddenly not really worked out the way that they wanted to or the way that they expected to. It can seem as if they've abandoned ship here. Let me explain to you. Look at chapter 5 on verse 15. Look at the way that the representatives of the Israelites went to Pharaoh here. They're almost like union leaders. That's the way I've got them in my head. In verse 15. Then the Israelite overseers went and appealed to Pharaoh. Do you remember? They'd just been worshipping God. And now they're going to Pharaoh because things have got tougher. And they said, why have you treated your servants this way? Your servants are given no straw. Yet we are told, make bricks. Your servants are being beaten, but the fault is with your own people. So a few moments ago, they were bowing their heads down, they were worshipping, and they were serving God. Now things haven't worked out the way that they want to, and they've suddenly gone to Pharaoh, and now they're crying out to Pharaoh, listen, as we are going to serve you as long as you ease the situation that I want. There's a lack of trust. They've lost faith in God, and now they're crying out to Pharaoh. Ultimately, I think what people do and what I read here is that people will worship and serve whoever makes their life easy. If you give me the things that I want now, then that's the person I'm going to follow. Who you ultimately work for is who you ultimately worship. They seem to have forgotten about the promises of God. And we struggle to trust in the promises of God because we only see what's happening now. I normally slag off social media because I think it creates a whole load of problems. But one of my friends actually last night took a photo of their devotions that he took from Genesis 48. And actually, it's what I'm trying to say this morning. This is what it said from one of his devotion books. His power, that's God's power, gives us hope that his promises never fail despite the darkest times. Let us seek grace to walk closely with this God all our days so that we may give him glory. That even though things aren't working out the way that you want to, or the way that you expect them, which God are you actually worshipping this morning? Which God are you actually serving? Who have you put your trust and your faith into? And that's why Jesus actually says, do you want to know who you're serving? Do you want to know who you're actually following? Who's the head of your household? If you want to know who that is, look at your wallet. I actually wrote down a few things for the members of the bridge here, and please, I'm only speaking to the members of the bridge, but there's people who sign up to the covenant and we pledge in order to know Jesus and to make him known, and we say we are invested as a community of body of believers in order to be on mission for God and let people know about Jesus, and we sign a declaration about that. And I'm saying, though, behind closed doors, when it comes to your bank account, when it comes to your time, is that what's reflected? Well, who really is in charge? And who is it that you're really worshipping here? Please don't get me wrong. Money isn't important. It's not about the money. Jesus says those things because it's about your heart. Because who is it you're serving for and who is it you're working for? And it reflects on who you ultimately worship. And after Moses turns to the Lord and he asks, why did you do these things, Lord? When he says at the end of chapter 5, why did you even send me? the greatest phrase that has been ringing in my ears for the last week. I love this. Right at the beginning of verse 1 of chapter 6. God says, okay, now you understand it's nothing to do with you, Moses. Now you understand it's nothing to do with the eloquent speech of Aaron. Now you understand it's actually nothing to do with Pharaoh. Okay. Well, now you will see what I will do to Pharaoh. Now you're going to see the fact that your salvation and you being rescued has everything to do with God. And God continues to repeat his promise throughout chapter 6. If you look at chapter 6 and verse 6 to 8, look at this. Therefore, this is what God tells Moses. Therefore, say to the Israelites, I am the Lord. I will bring you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. I will free you from being slaves to them. And I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with a mighty axe of judgment, which we're going to look at next week. I will take you as my own people and I will be your God. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God who brought you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. God was continuously rescuing a nation that had already and will continue to turn their backs upon God. So this book and the rest of the book and in the overall redemption, it's got nothing to do with the people. It's got everything to do with God and his perfect plan of salvation, because it ultimately is going to lead us to the security of the perfect plan of the salvation that's wrapped up in Jesus Christ. It's all to do with God's faithfulness, his sovereignty, his promises, and his ability, and not to do with ours. And do you know, while we continue to struggle, like Moses continued to struggle here, while we continue to have trust and faith in God in our present or in future situations, just like the Israelites struggle to trust and place their faith in God, do we realize that God's plan of salvation, it doesn't rest upon you, but it has everything to do with his son, Jesus, and his mediator. And that's why in Romans 5 it says, God showed his great love for us by sending Christ to die for us, that while we were still sinners, while we still screwed up, while we're so imperfect, there's nothing that we're able to do. And this book here is just demonstrating it is everything in order to do with God. And next week we're going to see how God judges sin. A holy God, a perfect God, cannot in any way bend or twist or just accept even just a smidgen of sin. He rejects it and he will judge it and it will be condemned, just like it was judged and condemned on the cross. And yet we're also seeing a God of mercy, a faithful God who rescues his chosen people. Who you ultimately work for is who you ultimately worship. And I just want to leave you with that whole phrase, and now you will see what I will do with Pharaoh. Whenever God turns to his people, and he's turning us this morning, now you will see what I will do. And we must rest upon him. I think we're going to close with our last song.
Let's stand, folks. Just sing one more song together. Come, my Father. Every blessing. thank you that we can see through your word that you are a faithful God. You're a mighty and a wonderful God. We thank you for the works that you did and that we can read of in the Israelites, Lord. I pray that we would remember what you've spoken to us this morning, Lord. Lord, that we would trust you and not do things in our own strength, Lord, but just let you take control, Father, and use us to do what you want us to do, Lord. I pray that you'll just guide us in our conversations now, Lord, that we would seek to be a blessing to one another, to be an encouragement. So, Father, just come and have your way, Father. We thank you for all your goodness and all that you've done for us, Lord. Amen.